Blog Talk Radio.
There's a better world to come and tell you why. There's a better world to come and tell you why. We will feed them on the land, on the sea, and in the sky. There's a better world to come and tell you why. There's a better world to come and don't you see? When we'll all be union and we'll all be free. There's a better world to come and don't you see?
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is your news director, Rick Spezak. I'm going to dispense with my normal announcements right at the beginning of the show, so I want to bring this special report on the privatization of schools in Chicago. Union teachers are under attack. Schools are under attack. The privatization goes on apace. What is now under attack in Chicago will be coming to a school district near you. Let me bring you Professor Mark Nason, professor of African-American Studies and History at Fordham University, director of Fordham's Urban Studies Program. He's also the author of many books on African-American history, urban history, and the history of sport. Ladies and gentlemen, Professor Nason from Fordham University.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to welcome Professor Nason from Fordham University to address the issues raised in the Chicago teacher strike and the issues faced there.
Right.
Professor Nason.
Yes. The Chicago teacher strike is the first attempt to challenge a series of policies that are part of the Obama administration's Race to the Top initiative that have had extremely destructive consequences for public schools in a number of the nation's cities. And I should say parenthetically that the Secretary of Education, who is the architect of those policies, Arne Duncan, comes out of Chicago. And so it's no accident that the most aggressive implementation of these policies is being done by Rahm Emanuel, the new mayor of Chicago, who was President Obama's former chief of staff. Now, these policies have several components. One is they require that teachers and schools must be evaluated in large part on student test scores. That's one component. Secondly, there is a school closing provision whereby if schools do not reach a certain threshold of test scores, the schools can be closed, half of their staff fired, and new schools put in their place, with the new schools being most often charter schools, either run by nonprofit or for-profit companies. And these policies, the evaluation of teachers and schools and test scores, and the closing of schools have had devastating consequences. One of the things is these are all in part designed to weaken teacher tenure and to put teachers under extreme pressure to improve student performance, especially in low-performing schools and schools in poor neighborhoods. But the consequences have produced results which are to the opposite of what they're alleged to do. So let's look at what happens when you have teachers now know that they are going to be rated on the basis of student test scores and that the school they're in can be closed and they can lose their jobs if those test scores don't reach a student threshold. What this will make the teachers do is spend all their energy teaching to the test to get students to reach that. It also creates an adversarial relationship between students and teachers because the students the kids are like the players on a team. The coach's job is dependent on their performance. So the teachers now have to put students under extreme pressure. One of the things is that this ratchets up the stress on teachers and students and makes students like not like to come to school because everything is boring test prep. But it's even worse in low-performing schools, because in those schools where you know that people are going to lose your jobs, they start eliminating gym, recess, sports, and the arts so that everybody can spend all day studying for tests. It's to like to go to school, you make them hate school. So the one of the, and let's look at another issue relating to this strike, because everything here is all about raising test scores and like driving students in poor neighborhoods into become high performers. Rahm Emanuel wants to spend a significant amount of money to increase the school day and also accelerate the school closings and eliminate more schools and put in more charter schools. What the union is saying is enough is enough. You're making our kids hate school. Take that money, put back the sports, put back the arts, put back the music, lower class size so we can have schools where kids want to go and really learn something. And, you know, because when, you know, a lot of, if you have a school where all they do all day is sit at a desk and study for bubble tests, you think that's a school where kids are going to want to go? This, to me, is a prescription for actually increasing, like, gang violence in Chicago, which is a huge problem. And the other thing is when schools are centers of community, when you close schools constantly, you undermine the community fabric. You take away an anchor, and you destabilize communities that desperately need, you know, institutions which are real community center and teachers which are mentors. You're constantly recycling the teachers, closing schools. You're turning these schools into centers of instability rather than community. And what's exciting about what's going on here is a union which is fighting for the children. They're saying, make school a place where these young people want to go. It's not just about our jobs. This is about saving the school as a community institution in Chicago. And it's also about stopping the profiteers and privatizers from coming in and setting up new schools and deluging the schools with tests. The tests are all produced by for-profit companies like Pearson. So every time you add a new test, somebody is making money. So, and then there's one other issue which is very important to me, because I work in the Bronx, which is, you know, a place where there is a huge obesity problem. If all these tests are eliminating gym and recess and after-school activity, these kids who already have problems with lack of recreation resources in their neighborhood get no physical activity. You're undermining their physical health as well as their mental health. So you have a policy that is an absolute nightmare that is being imposed by a Democratic president, a Democratic Secretary of Education, and is now being rammed through by a Democratic mayor. That's the tragedy. This isn't Republicans who are doing this to the children and teachers of Chicago. This is Democrats, and it's been hard for people to fight back. But the Chicago Teachers Union is sending a message around the country that this policy is wrong, it's destructive, it widens the achievement gap between poor kids and kids in more affluent districts. It makes kids hate school, it undermines community, it increases the potentiality for violence.
Thank you so much,
Esther.
Professor. Thank you so much. Hasn't teaching to a test been discredited for a very long time as an educational theory?
The problem is that the people who are developing these policies don't listen to education theorists. President Obama had an education summit, and it was all corporation executives. We have a Secretary of Education who never taught a day in his life. This is the problem, that what educators have spent their lives studying has no credibility in this administration, and would, have, by the way, have no credibility in the Romney administration. This is an attempt to apply business ethics and business methods to education, throwing away everything that teachers and education scholars have learned, you know, through their experience and research. And we know what a great job business methods did with AIG, with Bear Stearns, with Countrywide Insurance, with Chrysler, you know? So we're taking the methods, the business ethics and methods, which destabilized the world economy, and now applying them to education as though they're going to save us from racial and economic inequality.
Well, thank you so very much, Professor Nason, Professor of African American Studies and History at Fordham University and Director of Fordham's Urban Studies Program. Thank you so much, sir. You provided a great deal of insight. Have a good evening, sir.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Okay, for those of you who are concerned about the attacks to teachers' unions, and you're aware of the parent trigger bill here in Florida, make sure you track this, make sure you're involved, make sure you know what's going on. I want to give a shout out to our friends, the union activists in Orlando, who gave me a heads up on this resource. Thanks very much. Okay, I'm going to do a real quick set of announcements on events coming up, and then we'll get into our first guest. We have some wonderful guests tonight: Matthew Schwartz of Florida Wildlands, Rebecca Marks of Oceana, Drew Martin of Sierra Club and Water Board, and also our great friend, the Honorable Mark Pafford, Florida representative, a fantastic progressive activist, someone you all should know and someone we all need to continue to support. Okay, coming up, War versus Human Needs, Monday, September 17th. This is in Deerfield Beach. If you're nearby, you want to get in touch with them via warvhumanneeds@gmail.com. They're having a eat and socialize, bring a dish. January session will be with education and national priorities. And coming up also is the National Call-In Day to support Bradley Manning and put an end to investigations of anti-war and international solidarity activists. Real Politique is coming up October 27th. October 21st is the Space Coast Progressive Alliance Community in Action Progressive Fest. And I've got my first guest, so we'll go on to more announcements a little later. Let me bring on Mr. Matthew Schwartz. Good evening, Matthew.
Hey. Good evening, Richard. How are you doing today?
Very good, sir. Very good. What's new in Florida wildlife, sir? Give us an update.
You know, we're breaking up a little bit. I think you said what's new in wildlife?
Yes, in Florida wildlife, sir.
Okay, well, the group, my organization is called South Florida Wildlands Association. And at any given time, there's all kinds of things impacting Florida's wildlife. There's 6 million people living down here, and that in itself is always going to have a big impact on wildlife in Florida. Our organization does a lot of work on Florida panthers. So I guess the biggest thing, the first thing that comes to mind is the habitat loss that our state animal is facing right now from any one of a number of sources. The biggest thing right now that's in our minds is Florida Power and Light, FP&L, has decided to purchase 3,000 acres of Florida panther habitat north of the Big Cypress Preserve, and they want to build the largest gas plant in the country at that location, and that's going to displace a lot of panthers. It's also a massive, massive industrial development, and that's going to create havoc for panthers in the area. Also roads going in, new workers. The thing is going to use about 20 million gallons of water a day, so you got water impacts from that project. But there's things going on all over the place, Richard. I was just on the way back yesterday afternoon from the Keys. I stopped off at a lionfish derby in Key Largo, where people were educating others about lionfish that had taken over our reefs here in South Florida and gobbling up all the small fish that keep the reefs healthy. Go ahead.
What I was going to say is, I mean, it would seem to me before FPNL could build a big plant like that, there would have to be some public hearings. Do you know of any of those scheduled so that activists can get involved and share their opinion of such a grand scheme?
Well, there's going to be a number of hearings that are going on. There's nothing scheduled at the moment, but you're absolutely right. When a project like this goes through, it's got to get permitted by the Army Corps of Engineers because it's a wetland. It's got to get a biological opinion written by the Fish and Wildlife Service. The DEP, Florida Department of Environmental Protection, has to do an environmental resource permit. And South Florida Water Management District has to give them a consumptive use permit for all the water they're going to need to cool the cooling plants, to cool the turbines. So there will be hearings, public hearings coming up, public comment periods, and people can hopefully people get on my website or onto my mailing list, southfloridawild@yahoo.com is my email. And people can always contact me to get on a mailing list and be informed when these things are coming up. But it's pretty outrageous.
Why don't you go ahead and read your web address very slowly so that people can write it down?
Okay. So the web address is southfloridawild@yahoo.com. That's southfloridawild@yahoo.com. I have to admit, we have not been updating the website that much lately, and we're going to be changing that in the next couple of months. We're going to try to bring up all the things we've been working on the last 2.5 years and trying to have pages and campaigns. This one is going to get probably a page of its own, and maybe even a website of its own as this project develops. They could also email me, as I said, southfloridawild@yahoo.com. And they can go to our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/South Florida Wild. And I try to keep that one updated. That's the easiest one to update, so that's always got things on it.
Well, sure, but, and it has the additional benefit that a lot of people use Facebook as their primary digital communications nowadays. So that's great that you have that site. Go ahead, why don't you give that Facebook site again?
Okay, the Facebook page is facebook.com, so www.facebook.com/South Florida Wild, and that gets updated very regularly, and especially as this campaign develops, hopefully we're going to launch a pretty concentrated campaign with many different groups, many organizations fighting against this plant. I want to say one thing. When FPNL purchased this property, they purchased it a year ago in June of 2011, and
yeah,
they already knew from the Fish and Wildlife Service, they'd already been told that all of this property, with the exception of 6 acres, was primary habitat for the Florida panther. And when a company does this, knowing full well what they're doing, that's kind of, I guess the word is egregious. You know, that's a pretty strong violation. And what they know is that all of these agencies that I talked about, remember, this is not the first massive development to happen in Florida panther habitat. In fact, over the last 2 decades, the Fish and Wildlife Service has okayed roughly 140 different projects. So little by little, our state animal's habitat is getting whittled away. And each one, see, they go on this principle of jeopardy. So the Florida panther has no critical habitat, but it's an endangered animal. So they do a biological opinion, and they try to figure out, is this going to make the species extinct? And each time, so it's a university, a golf course, a shopping center, a housing development, they say, well, it'll be bad, but it ain't going to make the panther go extinct. So every time these projects come up, they okay it. And we expect that probably will happen here again. But hopefully, if people come together, you know, a few years before this one, in 2007, people came together when FPNL to build 2 coal plants not far from here in Glades County, not far from the FPNL plant in Hendry County in panther habitat. And people said no. They didn't want 2 new power plants run by coal right off of Lake Okeechobee. And eventually we got that one, the plug was pulled on that. So we're hoping that with some awareness of this project and people coming together and saying, no, I mean, hey, we pay FPNL. Ultimately, everything FPNL, everything they build is built with our money. So if the consumers understand that this is a project that the company has invested their money in and say, look, this is not how we want our money spent, that could maybe turn it around a little bit.
This must be that onerous government regulation that the teabaggers are always complaining about, huh?
Onerous? Which one are we talking about?
I was trying to be funny there, since they seem to always get their way, you know.
Well, this becomes a question of, you know, what happens a lot in Florida is property rights, and people say, well, I own it, let me build what I want on it. And if you're referring to that, I think that's something we've seen far too much of, because people really do have that attitude. If I own a piece of property and I have a lawyer and I have an architect and this is what I want to build, I'm going to get somebody to okay. I mean, the Hendry County Commission has already okayed this thing. I mean, I went to the commission meeting when they rezoned this and practically got on the floor on my knees begging them not to rezone this from agricultural land to the kind of zoning it needs to build actually the biggest fossil fuel power plant in the country, by the way. This thing is massive. 3,750 megawatts of electricity will be coming out, but that's the capacity. And well, it's a completely rural area.
Let me ask you this. Is this going to be – I mean, I would assume they're going to deliver this by pipeline, so there's going to have to be a pipeway guarantee coming through. And, of course –
You mean
then
to the gas?
Yeah. You said natural gas, right?
Yeah, the gas comes in from the Gulf. I mean, the country is awash in natural gas right now with all the fracking we're doing up north. So suddenly FPL has switched over to natural gas. Many utilities are doing that and saying this is a cleaner form of energy. But the pipeline, right, it's a gas pipeline that will come in from the Gulf and run to Hendry County, 2 miles west of Broward.
And then, of course, they're going to have to distribute the power out, so then there will be power lines going out too. So it's not
right,
just
well,
the footprint of the plant.
It's not just the footprint of the plant, but a plant that size in that particular location right outside the Big Cypress Preserve, and also right outside the Seminole Reservation. The Seminoles have already sued them, or sued the county anyway, over the zoning. And unfortunately, they weren't successful. So there'll be other opportunities. But, you know, we can't rely, unfortunately, we can't rely on companies like, I mean, this is not the project, by the way, that FPL has in mind in terms of, I hate to be just harping on FPL, but we have little time, and they do have quite a bit in the fire. They want to build two nuclear plants right on the shore of Biscayne Bay, right next to Biscayne National Park. In an area that almost surely is going to be underwater in the not too distant future. And the power lines for that one, they want to run right along the east side of Everglades National Park, inside the current borders of Everglades National Park. So I guess when FPL looks at our national parks and our wildlife habitat, they see a vacant lot. We see something else. And there's going to be some big fights over all these projects.
Well, let's hope that the voice of the public is heard. So you mentioned the lionfish issue, the FPL's plant grow out. Are there any other pressing issues that our audience needs to hear about, brother?
Well, the biggest thing is always, I mean, one environmental organization can't be everywhere, and we really do focus on the Florida Panthers. So our focus is on all the developments out there in the west, what they call the Western Everglades, which a lot of other people call Collier County and Eastern Collier County. There's a new development being planned called the Town of Big Cypress on the west side of the Big Cypress Preserve and just outside the Florida Panther National Wildlife Refuge. They want to build a new interchange off I-75 right near there. Panthers are trying to get panthers outside of South Florida on the other side of the Clusac River, and there's a project called Babcock Ranch, a new development plan for there. So as many people that live in South Florida, apparently the economy, the growth economy, and the idea of creating new jobs by creating more sprawl seems to be still on the table. I mean, that's when we have a governor that ran under the campaign of let's get to work, environmental regulations kill jobs, let's get around these environmental regulations, and we've had a history of just growing more and more homes, houses, developments, roads, businesses in Florida. I think that where people need to be thinking is how can we create a sustainable economy in South Florida that's not based on paving over what's left. The panther is really the canary in the coal mine. I mean, it's the panther in the coal mine because the scientists who study the issue have said that panthers are down to the nub right now. In other words, what's left is what that animal needs to survive. This is a big cat. this is a, you know, a male could be a 150-pound animal, needs could roam 20 miles in a night of hunting. So this is an animal that has a lot of range. A male has a 200-square-mile range, female less than that. But still, these are big cats that need to roam. And that land is being gobbled up. So there's a big conflict right now between wildlife habitat and the Florida economy. And until we're able to put our economy on a different course that's not built on, you know, based on just growing new houses that eventually go into foreclosure anyway. I mean, every cycle has always gone that way. But there's a certain point where you have to say enough is enough. And that's what our organization is trying to say. If you're going to do any development at all, do it in the cities. Build up the areas that need the help. Put the, you know, the new power plants in places where people live, where they work, and do it sustainably. Put solar on people's roofs. I mean, think how many people would go to work in a solar technology. And we've got more solar potential in South Florida than any place in the eastern United States. We rival the Southwest in terms of the sun we have here. So there's lots of ways we can do things differently, but we're not.
Well, hopefully there'll be some progressive minds at play when we start to evaluate where Florida's economic future lies, because obviously we can only pave so much of Florida before it becomes completely an unsustainable habitat. I want to thank you so much, Matthew, for keeping us aware of what's going on with Florida's wildlands. Please, when you hear about these hearings coming up, let us know. We'd love to have you back to talk about it, okay?
We'll do that. Thanks a lot, Rick, for having me on.
Okay, buddy. You take care of yourself and keep a good work.
Thank you. Okay. Now, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Okay. Our next guest is here. We've got Rebecca Marks of Oceana. Rebecca,
hey, Rick,
welcome.
How are you doing? Oh, thank you for having me.
Oh, it's our pleasure, Rebecca. It's our pleasure. Why don't you tell us a little bit about Oceana?
Well, great. Well, I work here with the Climate and Energy Campaign for Oceana. And Oceana is an international organization, and we seek to replenish the oceans to their natural state before all this damage we've done recently. And what we're working on right here in Florida is really stopping seismic testing and advancing of offshore drilling.
Well, excellent. Excellent. Why don't you tell us a bit about yourself?
Well, great, yeah. Well, my name is, actually, I've grown up in Florida my whole life. So I'm a natural Floridian, and I went to school at University of Central Florida for political science. So political awareness and activity has always been ingrained in my life from childhood. My parents, they really did a great example of showing me what a politically engaged citizen should look like and do. So I always knew from childhood that I wanted a career that I'd be proud of, and working for an organization that I would be proud of. So that's a big reason why I worked for Oceana. But I didn't always consider myself necessarily an environmentalist per se. I did a lot of work, you know, with Planned Parenthood, American Civil Liberties Union, and other really great organizations. But what really got me interested in the environment and what's at stake for the next couple of generations to come was really the BP oil spill. I think it was a really big wake-up call for a lot of people, and it certainly was for me. I mean, the total catastrophe that was that event, I think, really could have been a huge, huge game change in how we see offshore drilling and the dangers of it. But I think that the oil companies really did such a tremendous job in fooling the public and making it all about just BP's fault, you know? Kind of shift, the change.
It was a unique incident.
Yeah, exactly. That's how they tried to phrase it, and which was really, of course, not the truth. Oceana on the website has a really great link where you can see it has all the activity of all the oil spills that happen every day. And they have little flags all across the world, and you can see live updates, and there's at least one spill a day, usually multiple. And these spills never get broadcasted because, obviously, it's not as big to the media as the BP oil spill, which, I mean, for obvious reasons, that was a total catastrophe. But they manipulated and had complete control of the dialogue that was really going on then. And exactly what you said, made it an isolated incident when, in fact, it's not. And it's actually the usual course of offshore drilling.
Rebecca, let me ask you this. Let me ask you this, if I may. As I'm sure you remember, we were all told a couple months after it was finally sealed, to the extent that it was sealed, that, it's all disappeared. All that oil, all that Corexit has just vanished. I'm guessing that you weren't really fooled by that.
No. I don't think most people that give a second glance to it fooled by that. And if you ask anybody there, they can tell you the facts that they see day in and day out. But what's coming up right now, I mean, that was just there in the Gulf, right? And we saw the total devastation that happened after that. What they're now proposing, and that the Secretary of Interior, Secretary Salazar, will be deciding on in sometime in December. We know it'll happen either between December 1st to December 31st, is a total opening of really the whole Atlantic coast to seismic testing, which is the precursor to offshore drilling. So they're willing to gamble on our whole Atlantic coast, you know, put up not just the local ecosystems, the local tourism industry, local fishery businesses, really putting in a gamble because of this, because seismic testing is a dangerous procedure before the next dangerous procedure of offshore drilling.
Could you explain seismic testing? Now, I happen to have been involved with underground testing, underground radar testing, And I'm afraid that many people are not aware of what that means by seismic testing when it comes to tracing the ocean floor. Why don't you go ahead and walk our audience through that?
I definitely will. So seismic testing, I actually had to be explained this from my boss because I too really didn't know really what the dangers were with seismic testing or what it really was. I mean, I had an idea, but not really. Well, the seismic testing that these oil companies do before they can test if an area can be drilled is they tow it along a boat with an air gun, and they release a sound so loud that it can actually penetrate, you know, past the seafloor to see where oil is. So it has to bounce all the way down and back up. So you can imagine this noise. To put in perspective of what this noise would sound like, imagine standing underneath a jet engine going off over your head every 10 seconds because they release this noise every 10 seconds for a period of time. Except if you're directly underneath it, the sound waves are so loud that most living creatures above a certain size, like fish, whales, and dolphins especially, will die, usually. The case of this would happen was in Peru recently when they did that about in April of this year. Hundreds of dolphins washed upon the shore after they opened up seismic testing, usually with blood in their ears. And this noise is that loud that it really damages whole entire areas, whole entire ecosystems, and can actually go for miles, that whales and dolphins miles away can actually be impaired, specifically hearing impaired, and won't be able to communicate with each other or their children, and really is detrimental to whole populations of marine life. So this is obviously a concern for many people, not just people who believe in the conservation of our oceans, but fishermen and local tourism business owners. And it's really dangerous, especially because this seismic testing, the air gun way, is dangerous, but there actually will be a safer seismic testing, we call it Option C, that will be perfected in the next 3 to 5 years. So the safer seismic testing will actually be available before 2018, which is when they want to start the offshore drilling. So you tell me, Rick, why wouldn't they wait to the safer testing to do offshore drilling, and if it's going to be available before they can even do that? And it's really because I believe that, you know, these oil companies want to go ahead right now to get started, to have us tied on to offshore drilling for the next generations to come. And it's really sad because what's going to suffer is how healthy our oceans are, really.
And, of course, we've all heard that with the melting of the Arctic ice, they're looking to expand their Arctic drilling.
Mm-hmm.
And go ahead.
No, continue. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, and of course, since this is a very much more remote site than off of the Gulf, out of sight, out of mind, I think they're counting on that.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the crazy part about it is that you would think it would just be out of sight, out of mind, but, you know, it's just been a few years after the BP oil spill, and, you know, they've got so much of a good game plan going on that they're getting literally our Secretary of Interior to pretty much okay a whole expansion of a whole coast after it's only a few years later. I mean, the seismic testing would happen, 3 years after BP? It's going to happen early 2013. And, I mean, that's the scarier thing about it, is that it's not even so much, they don't even have to worry anymore about out of sight, out of mind. They're moving in on it, and that's why we're really trying to do this push. We're trying to get as many photo petitions, trying to tell Secretary Salazar and our local politicians we're going to be giving a ring up to tell them that we don't want this happening, you know? And it's going to stop in Daytona, Florida. But, of course, as you know, with the tide of the ocean, if an oil spill happens in Daytona, we're going to feel the effects of it all the way down South Florida. And it's going to really ruin a lot of things. And so we're just trying to get everybody talking about seismic testing, letting them know about that. We're hopefully having a demonstration in October 3rd. The location we're still working on, but it's probably going to be right at Government Center in downtown Miami. So I'll definitely be keeping you updated on that, Rick.
Great. So, yeah. Why don't you tell our listeners how they can get in touch with Oceana?
Yeah, definitely. Well, me specifically, a really great way to keep in contact, of course, as you know, Facebook is a great tool. Our Facebook page for our local Florida chapter is Oceana Florida. We also have an Oceana page for the whole organization, oceana.org. Also, if anybody is interested in, you know, reaching out, volunteering, my email is rmarquez, M-A-R-Q-U-E-S, at oceana.org. We're really looking, Rick, to build as many people who want to get active here in Florida to get active, because we know that when enough people are getting involved, people are going to listen. And maybe we can't influence Secretary Salazar from right here in Florida, but we can certainly send a clear message to our elected officials here and local media, and hopefully getting people talking about this and knowing what kind of damage this really can do.
Well, you know, it always surprises me how often people are casual or cavalier about the environment that we live in. I was involved in a presentation for the Water and Sewer Department down in Dade County one time, and they were having a lot of trouble getting funds to repair sewage pipes underneath Biscayne Bay. And they were leaking, and they couldn't get the money from the county government to repair them. And I said, you know, gentlemen, I do multimedia presentations. I said, you've got to make it very plain. You've got to say, if these sewage pipes are not repaired, what's going to happen is geysers of human waste are going to destroy Biscayne Bay. And they said,
yeah.
Oh, no, we can't say that. And I said, but you know it's true. And they said, yeah, but that's a distasteful thing to say. And I said, you know, if you want funding, what we should do is we should do a presentation that shows signs up and down, you know, the most expensive land that you can find on Miami Beach, with signs saying, do not enter the water. It is hazardous to your health. And they said, oh, my God, we can't do that. And I said, but failing to repair it will mean that that's exactly what will happen.
No, that's a huge part of what we're seeing with everything, though. I mean, it's just kind of a total lack of wanting to accept facts. It's what I see it in common logical thinking when it comes to environment.
Well, I understand there is a local or there's a national political party who claimed that their messages would be fact-free, that they were not going to be bound by fact-checkers. And I think that's the most curious point of view.
I mean, and you see this going, and that's one of the things I really want to do here in Florida. One of the things I learned about when you said, you know, there's kind of like a disconnect when it comes to the environment and a lot of activism, and it's very strange. You know, people have a kind of disconnect from it. I think sometimes it's too big of a problem for people to really understand or really want to believe. I think sometimes it comes off scary, and I think it comes off political, and it's very weird because it's really a bipartisan issue, or at least it should be. And
well, there's nothing political about when you can breathe the air and go in the water.
Exactly, and you know we have now. I believe, Oceana doesn't endorse any candidate, and right now, honestly, or any party platform, because we really shouldn't at any point, because no party has been really good at helping the environment. But you have, what was really shocking to me was the other day it came on CNN and said that John Kerry had said climate change is not a hoax. And I remember thinking how bizarre that had to be said, that and no one would actually do anything to prevent climate change. But the fact that we're still back at that conversation, that we have to actually say this is not a hoax of what we're talking about, and that just blew my mind. And I was like, how far back do we go when it comes to talking about the environment? I mean, you know, people want to take away the EPA, and really a lot of things have deemed any kind of political action really just kind of ineffective, and it's really sad, and it's a really important time, I believe, to get involved in really
let's take the positive side right now. You are on the side of the angels doing work to protect our oceans, and that's good news, and that you're helping other people become aware of, number one, what's going on, and number two, what they can do to make it better, and that's good news, and that's fantastic, and I thank you for the work that you're doing. What's coming up with Oceana?
Right now, again, what we really just shifted our whole climate energy campaign to focus on stopping seismic testing. We have an event next Friday if you're in the Fort Lauderdale area. We're trying to really get younger people excited about this and different groups because we have a really good variety of people that take their time to be invested. But we're going to have actually a night out to save the oceans at America's Backyard, which is a bar in Fort Lauderdale. And if you come next Friday, you get in for free, get a couple drinks, and it's really great to see how local businesses have embraced helping us out. So I'm really excited about that. But also upcoming in October 3rd is going to be really our day of action, which I hope, Rick, we can talk again about, because once I get the details on that, we're really excited to make that as big as possible. We're going to give people a taste about seismic testing, try to educate the public, get some media press, and show people how absolutely, you know, horrible it is to have a loud noise going every 10 seconds in the place you live. So we're really excited.
Well,
you can
count on an invitation to bring you back, my dear.
Great. Fantastic.
Many people do not realize, you know, people have this, you know, idea, because when they look at the oceans, they think, oh, my God, it's so big. But the problem is it's not the place where everybody can dump their garbage, and there's no consequence.
I know. And it's so simple, a lot of the solutions, the basic solutions we can come to. So hopefully we keep ticking away at, you know, that big problem with some real solutions, real simple things like, you know, offshore wind. Offshore wind alone here in Florida can power half of our homes. And if we can keep ticking away at that, keep getting those small changes to happen that are going to have a big impact, I believe overall, you know, we'll be on the winning side and things will be really good for us.
Well, the important thing is that we are standing there with our Mother Earth. We are standing here to protect the oceans, protect the wildlife. And that's the good thing. We are sitting with nature, and there's nothing better than that. Rebecca, is there any final thoughts you want to leave our audience with?
Tell your local officials to not allow that seismic testing. Write to Secretary Salazar and like Oceana Florida on Facebook so we can be in touch and work together to build a better environmental network.
Okay, now we'll have you back before that October 4th thing to remind our audience, okay?
That sounds great. Thank you so much, Rick.
Oh, you're very welcome and wonderful to have you on, dear.
Have a good one.
Okay, keep up the good work. Okay. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's another great report from people out there doing the good work. There's a better world coming when we put our shoulders to the wheel. There's a better world coming when we work together to stand and protect the earth, to stand and protect the air, the sea, the water, the land, the wildlife. And, you know, somebody said to me, well, Rick, you know, how can you do that story about the Chicago teacher strike? And I said, well, to me, children are part of our environment. Education is part of our cultural environment. The world that we live in, the work that we do, the way our families grow, the way we educate ourselves, that's part of the human environment. And that's why I thought it was important to do besides its timeliness. And now I'd like to bring you a report from Drew Martin with both the Sierra Club and the Palm Beach Water Board. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to bring you Drew Martin. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to welcome Drew Martin of the Sierra Club, and also, Drew, what is your full title, sir?
I am the vice chair of the Palm Beach County Soil and Water Conservation District.
Super. And I know we've got some issues that are going on right now you want to get our audience aware of, so why don't you go ahead and give us the update, sir?
Well, right now we have a lot of issues going on, as you know, with hurricane and flooding. And that has a lot to do with the fact that we've developed too many areas. And we also have a lot of problems to do with water quality. Water quality is a huge issue in Florida. And the Sierra Club had originally sued the state to bring the EPA into Florida to enforce the Clean Water Act. Governor Scott has resisted that enforcement and has instead asked the state to come up with its own standards. What the EPA had to set up was what is called as numeric nutrient criteria. A numeric nutrient criteria is where you give a requirement that water quality must meet a specific standard. And the standard that we're talking about meeting was to reduce the amount of phosphorus and nitrogen in the waters. And the one specific type of reduction is in reducing the amount of fertilizer that people are using. Fertilizer is a huge cause of phosphorus pollution. And we see right now a lot going on with the destruction of the Indian River Lagoon. So those are the main issues that are going on right now.
Why don't you talk a little bit about this algae situation?
Okay. Well, basically algae is what is called, right now we have something called a brown tide. A brown tide is where you have a specific type of algae that is occurring. And algae, basically, once it gets into the water, it goes ahead and it dies. And when it dies, it creates a specific type of problem, and that is a problem where the water loses its oxygen level. And when water loses its oxygen level, it slowly kills everything in it. The other problem is you also have a lot of problems with the fish and the plants because fish require a certain amount of dissolved oxygen in water. Now, originally, the EPA was supposed to set a dissolved oxygen standard. So the state is so much less rigorous in its approach, and that's what the big concern is. The state is allowing many of these waters to die because the state would much rather wait until the waters are extremely damaged to do something. So that is the basic set of problems going on right now.
Now, is the state still in court suing the EPA?
Well, there was what happened is the state was able to put pressure on the EPA through various politicians to back off. So what happened is the Sierra Club sued, the EPA agreed to the EPA lost the suit, the federal government lost the suit, and in that they agreed to come into Florida and establish nutrient standards. However, politicians in the state of Florida put on a lot of pressure And they basically, the pressure was for the EPA to back off. And so what's happened is, even though the Sierra Club had won the suit with a couple of other plaintiffs, ultimately the EPA backed off and allowed the state to establish its own criteria rather than forcing a strict criteria on the state. And so the state, there were a series of meetings, and the state established its own criteria, which is less severe than the criteria which EPA would have established. So it's kind of a two-edged sword in that EPA did back off voluntarily, but it backed off because of pressure from the state and politicians in the state of Florida, and also threats on the part of Congress to defund EPA. And as we know, the Republican Party is using the excuse that environmental protection is damaging the economy. Of course, we know that's not true. The problems that really come to the economy do not have anything to do with environmental protection. It has to do with lack of regulation in the financial industry and the outsourcing of jobs overseas. The party has used the excuse of financial regulation, and so that was also one of the arguments to prevent the EPA from establishing a strict, severe criteria that would have really improved water quality in the state. You have to remember that the establishment of things like improved water quality greatly improves the economy, because it requires that the expenditure of funds. It's just like when the U.S. decided to go to the moon. We spent money, we created new technologies. It's the same thing. When you require an improvement in environmental regulation, people have to build things that improve water quality. So, in a sense, it would have improved the economy had the EPA forced the state to do more. But unfortunately, right now the Department of DEP is in control, and they're coming up with regulations that are going to be much less rigorous than the federal government would have done under the EPA.
Can you explain the relationship between releasing water from the lake and algae accumulation in the outflow areas?
Well, basically, Lake Okeechobee originally flowed south into the Everglades. And so the flow south was what they would describe as very nutrient poor. And nutrient poor means that there were very little nitrogen and phosphorus in that water. Now, when the lake flooded the hurricane in 1928, the federal government began a process where they built a berm around Lake Okeechobee to block flooding south. And in doing that, if they did that, they created two outlets, one to the Caloosahatchee and one to the St. Lucie River. And those two outlets are where the water now goes when the lake is in a high water situation. Because the lake water is so dirty and has so much phosphorus and nitrogen already accumulating in it, when the water flows into those estuaries, it first overflows the estuaries with fresh water, but it also overflows the estuaries with very poor quality water, which then any kind of phosphorus or nitrogen in that water then stimulates the growth of algae in the estuaries.
Okay, so that's how we get lots of algae growth there.
That's how we get lots of algae growth in there. At the same time, it also floods the estuaries, and oftentimes those estuaries require a certain balance between salt and fresh water. So you go from times when there's no water because we block the water flow. So in dry times, the rivers often have too much salinity, which causes a damage to those estuaries, and at other times there's too much fresh water, which reduces the amount of salinity and also is damaging, as well as adding the phosphorus and nitrogen to those estuaries.
Now, the source for all these nutrients in the lake, is this more, I mean, obviously it's by and large mostly agriculture. Is it more cattle or is it more sugar?
Well, originally the sugar is actually
south of the lake.
It was mostly in the beginning the result of dairies, which were north of the lake. There were a lot of dairies and cattle operations. The problem is that there were no buffers for the water when it flowed off those properties. In other words, you can do things which are referred to as best management practices that capture the nutrients before they flow off the land. But of course, originally there was not that much development, and there was a lot of opportunity to cause pollution, and the lake was able to absorb it for many years. But it was more than just agricultural operations. We also have problems with when Orlando was developed, a lot of pollution came south. And originally, Florida never did a very good job with water pollution. You know, a lot of people want what are known as septic tanks, and if septic tanks are not managed properly, septic tanks can leach nutrients into the environment. We see this in North Florida with the springs issue. We also have a lot of utilities that did a fairly poor job of handling their own sewage. And we see this off the coast of southeast Florida, where we had these ocean outfalls, where a lot of sewage was just basically dumped in the ocean. And originally, there was almost no water quality treatment, and then during the 60s, the EPA and in the 70s, we saw the creation of the Clean Water Act, and we saw an attempt to really improve water quality. But we still have a lot of not good water quality being dumped. We still have problems with septic tanks. The legislature had come up with a law that required that septic tanks be inspected every 7 years. The Tea Party opposed because they didn't want people to have to pay for an inspection. So now septic tanks are not monitored that carefully. We had the attempt by EPA to create high-quality water standards through nutrient numeric criteria, which would have required utilities to clean up their outfalls and clean up their sewage as it came out, because even partially treated sewage has a certain amount of nitrogen and phosphorus in it. So those were all issues, as well as agricultural industry. Now, sugar is a problem in the sense that when they back pump, I mean, most of the sugar is south of Lake Okeechobee, and so the water does not flow directly into the lake. But what the sugar industry did for 30 years was they took their water and they pumped it back into the lake, which did cause water pollution in the lake. Now, under Charlie Crist, Governor Crist, that process was stopped. Now we have the sugar industry once again using the problems with the Coosawchee River to try to reestablish back pumping, again putting their pollution back into the lake. Now, the industry argues that they've improved their practices and their water is of better quality than water coming to the lake now from north of the lake. However, adding pollution to pollution is still pollution. So regardless of the fact that they have improved the treatment of their water, we still would like to continue the process of reducing nutrients and not putting them back into Lake Okeechobee.
Well, thank you. That's really an important chunk of information. Let me ask you this. Right now, in the aftermath of Hurricane Isaac, we're hearing a lot of complaints about flooded communities out in the western portion of Palm Beach County and related areas. And, of course, this raises a lot of subsidiary issues. You know, you mentioned earlier the septic tanks. I heard a woman mention that she can't use her well because her well's underwater. And, of course, all those homes out there, of course, they're not being served by any kind of sewer system. Even if they were, it would be flooded as well. Here they're in the most difficult position of having both wells and septic tanks flooded out. I'm sure there's going to be lots of political noise. What do you see is the best approach now to create either proper drainage or, you know, best practice land use to avoid some of this flooding issues?
Well, the problem in Florida has always been that it's overdevelopment, and that is that Florida is a very sensitive landscape. Originally, most of Florida was wetlands, except for the areas right along the coast and, of course, North Florida.
Coastal Ridge, yeah.
So what happened is, originally, when they began to develop, they would just drain the land and build on it. And originally, of course, under early Florida business environment, was basically the goal just to drain everything. They didn't really give a thought of what the result was. They just basically decided, hey, we've got all this land, it's underwater. Most of the time, or a good portion of the year, let's just drain it, and they didn't think about the consequences. But ultimately, the difficulty is that you have to leave a certain amount of land vacant to provide wetlands, because Florida is is limestone, and limestone's very porous. So if you leave water on limestone over a certain period of time, it will, basically, the land will absorb it. Well, the more you put in cement and roads and build on it, you basically are blocking the limestone from receiving the water. So that's the first problem. The second thing is you're dependent now upon drainage rather than the natural approach, which the water would flow into the low-lying wetlands. So when you build, you would build on the high ground, and then you would create low ground. That's why a lot of times there's a pond next to a house, because they would basically take the land, they would put a portion of it on, and create high ground, and then build a pond so that it would absorb the water. Well, what happens is people just assume that, because most of the time the land looks dry, so they just assume, well, we don't need that pond anymore. We don't need that wetland anymore. So now you have a lot of cases where people go and fill in the ponds. And we see this. People are asking, oh, can we fill in our pond? Because I want to put a yard out there. I want to raise a horse out there. So they began removing a lot of the wetlands. Also, they didn't leave any wetlands in between the developments. In other words, leave vacant space between developments that could absorb water. What done is relied completely on the South Florida in the area of South Florida, where we have what's called the South Florida Water Management District. They completely rely on the ability of that district to pump the water off the land, which works majority of the time, but when you have a severe rain, the pumps just can't move fast enough. At the same time, we have what is right now this sea level rise gradually taking place. Well, a lot of these pumps are gravity pumps, and they work on the idea that sea level is lower than the level of the land. But as we all know, Florida is extremely flat, and as you pump water off the land itself, the land begins to oxidize and sink. So we actually have sinking land, a rising sea, and a lack of places to put the water because people have removed their ponds, people have removed wetlands near their homes. And so we're seeing a series of bad decisions. And as people continue to lobby for development in the area, and many of these areas in western Palm Beach County have been overdeveloped, we still see continuing development, where we still see more and more people wanting to build more and more things, not leaving enough vacant land to absorb the floodwaters. And this is going to become a serious problem as we move forward in the future, because we are not allowing enough vacant land to absorb floodwaters in these serious storms.
Yeah, this raises in my mind the whole idea of these mitigation banks, where they're going to have a bunch of wetlands in north central Florida, and they can use that as a land mitigation. And sure, they can just build and build and build down here, because they're going to use credits from this mitigation in another part of the state. It's completely illogical, because that's not the way the planet works. That's not the way water and gravity work.
Right. And worse, the mitigation bank is being done in a very poor quality way, in which, as you follow the news stories, and I know you have, because I can tell from your question, that people realize that these mitigation banks are, in many cases, not in true wetlands. This is a big problem now. The head DEP regulator was nearly fired because she objected to using poor quality land for mitigation, using land that wasn't true wetlands to offset wetlands destruction. So we're going to see more and more flooding problems, and now the state is trying to accelerate the permit process so they can even destroy land wetlands more quickly. Mother Nature eventually is going to come back to bite you when you violate the rules of Mother Nature, which is you have to have the land set aside to absorb the floodwaters, give the limestone a chance to absorb the water. You cannot rely on pumping completely, and you cannot develop all the land and not expect to see flooding.
You and I have talked about equal and opposite problem of drawing more water out while simultaneously putting more septic tanks in. We'll leave that problem aside for just a second. Let me ask you another related question. Is it too early? Have you heard any numbers of how much water we've gotten from the passage of Isaac?
Well, I mean, I understand the lake picked up 13 inches in the last day or so. I think we might gain more depending upon, runoff. I know in some areas of Palm Beach County we got well over 10 inches. So, I mean, we got a significant amount of rain, and these flooding events will occur. The amazing thing is that people are so surprised when it occurs, because it's really not a shock if you look at how land is done that this is going to occur. And whenever you have a development and you drive around Western Palm Beach County, and you see that they every time you see a nice spot where there's some trees and some vacant land, you see a for sale sign on it, which means that this is going to get worse every year, because we're going to continue to allow every piece of vacant land to be built on, except for those lands that are not already established as reserves or conservation lands. And oftentimes, we even had an issue where the Palm Beach County took a permanent conservation easement and removed it. It was only on an acre of land, but that's a dangerous precedent, because we need to have land set aside to take on this excess water.
Well, even though there's a significant number of people that do pay attention to environmental issues, I'm afraid for a lot of Floridians, the environment is what they bump into on the weekends, and they only pay attention to it when it impacts their golfing or their other outing plans. Do you have, I know Sierra Club has done wonderful work trying to educate people on you know, serious environmental issues that really cannot be ignored. Can you tell us anything about some of the new initiatives that Sierra Club is doing?
Yes, we're going to be having a seminar on September 29th in Broward County on the coastal problems, and it's working on the issues to have to do with reefs, outfalls, and water pollution in the oceans, as well as fisheries management. So we're focusing on that. And reefs are an important part. The two things that protect us in these storms are, first of all, vacant land that absorbs the excess water, but reefs that catch a lot of the storm surge, along with our mangrove estuaries. So, you know, reefs are an important part of Florida's ecology, and also an important part of Florida's economy. And reefs are suffering a lot of degradation because of nutrient pollution and impurities in the water. And whenever you have these algal blooms, you block the sunlight. Florida had extremely clean and clear water, and many of the plants and structures we have, such as reefs, seagrass, require crystal clear water to operate properly, because the sunlight has to penetrate the water. As water quality becomes worse and water becomes opaque, as we see has happened in Lake Okeechobee, it has a serious damage to your seagrasses, which are a nursery for your fishes. So, and the same thing happens with your reefs. If you have opaque water, reefs cannot receive the sunlight they need, as well as water pollutants can kill reefs. And this is the other issue. So the Sierra Club is going to be working on reef protection. That's going to be an important new issue that we're going to be taking on.
Well, I hope you guys get a chance to do some webcasting for that, because I'm sure there's a lot more people would like to hear that than will be able to actually attend in person. Let me ask you one final question, sir. Are there any issues that our listeners can help with in the next month or so?
Voting is going to be an important issue, and I think that there's a clear choice. The Republican Party is clearly trying to turn the clock back on environmental protection. If that happens, things are going to get worse. We're going to see greater pollution, greater flooding, greater problems. The issue with flooding is not going to go away. We really need to elect people that are better on the environment than the Republican Party. The Republican Party originally was much more even-handed. There were Republicans who cared about the environment and some who didn't care. As we go back and we look at the Theodore Roosevelt, who was a Republican. But the Republican Party today is not the Republican Party of Theodore Roosevelt, because right now there are no progressives in the Republican Party and no one who cares about environmental protection. If the Republican Party wins this election and they turn back the clock in the environment, we're going to see severe problems, and particularly with global climate change, because the Republican Party is basically controlled by climate change deniers who don't even believe in global climate change as an issue. And that is going to be a serious problem for the future of this country. So the one thing people can do is to vote candidates that care about the environment, and to please not support particularly these right-wing candidates that make statements like, climate change is natural, it's not human caused. and are not willing to put strong environmental enforcement into the laws. It has not hurt the economy to have environmental enforcement. If anything, it benefits the economy because when companies have to go out and buy equipment to clean their outfalls, their sewage, it creates jobs. And that's the way we have to look at it. We need a strong environment.
Let's hope that people start electing civil servants who respect science and don't fear it.
Right. And we did see a good election in Martin County where we saw candidates who were more in tune with the environment elected, and they were, some were Republicans. So it's not strictly a party thing, but we have to look at those candidates and what they're going to do for the environment and elect candidates that are going to be better for the environment than candidates who argue strictly in favor of business.
You know, it never ceases to amaze me when I hear these conservatives decrying tree huggers and environmentalist types, because they seem to somehow forget that humans are part of the environment.
That's right. Humans are, and humans rely on the natural environment. We cannot ignore the natural environment. When we saw that happen with Katrina in New Orleans, when they ignored the natural environment, many people lost their lives. We have to work in tandem with nature, not try to work against it.
Well, thank you so much, Drew. I sure appreciate you coming. As always, you're always an informative guest. You take care, and best of luck in all the work that you do.
Thank you so much, Rick. It's a pleasure being on your show.
Okay, bye-bye. And that was Drew Martin of the Palm Beach County Soil and Water Board. I want to do some announcements and read a few news stories while we're waiting for our next and final guest, the Honorable Representative Mark Pafford. As you may have heard, there's been an amazing Arctic melting going on. They call it unprecedented, amazing, Goliath. Scientists are marveling at the Arctic sea ice drop. They say it may be completely gone in 20 years during the summertime. This year's melting season is Goliath, noted geophysicist Mark Tedescu, director of Cryospheric Processes Laboratory at the City University of New York, the Wall Street Journal wrote, the ice is being lost at a very strong pace. These scientists' opinions are not anomalies. Weather Underground co-founder Jeff Masters writes that every major scientific institution that tracks Arctic sea ice agrees that new records for low ice area, extent, and volume have been set. These organizations include the University of Washington Polar Science Center, a new record for low ice volume, the Nansen Environmental and Remote Sensing Center of Norway, the University of Illinois' Cryosphere Today, National Snow and Ice Data Center illustrates the melt that since 1979, the graph below showing a decline in the ice extent at 10.2% per decade. By the way, I'm sure you're all surprised that BP's tar balls were churned up by Isaac and washed ashore. Scientists at Louisiana State University ran tests on large globes of oil waste known as tar balls that washed up on the shores of two Louisiana beaches. Tests reveal that the waste matches the biological makeup of the hundreds of millions of gallons of oil that originated from the BP spill. Since Hurricane Isaac landed last week, tar balls have been washing up on beaches in Alabama, Louisiana, and on Tuesday, a large tar mat was discovered on the beach at Louisiana's Elmer Island, according to The Guardian. State officials were forced to close a 13-mile stretch of beach and restricted fishing in the area. Ed Overton, an LSU chemist who did the state test, told The Guardian that more oil was likely buried along the coast, but it's difficult to uncover and clean up. A team of scientists stated that since 2010, tropical storms have consistently washed up oil debris along the coast. We're in year three, and it seems to be a new normal for the Gulf Coast, said researcher Joel Hayward. Radiation 258 times legal limit found in fish off Fukushima. This is way back in August 23rd. Fish containing 258 times the legal limit of cesium have been found in waters off the crippled Fukushima No. 1 nuclear power plant. The plant operator, Fukushima's Tokyo Electric Power Company. The reading for two rock trout caught at 20 kilometers to the north of the plant showed 25,800 becquerels per kilogram, the highest yet detected in surveys conducted after last year's nuclear accident. And this other story, alarming levels of radiation detected in fish caught off Fukushima. TEPCO announced that they're measuring radiation exposure in fish and shellfish caught within 20 kilometers. Said 20 kinds of fish and shellfish from five locations had above over 380 times more than the government safety limit. Plutonium has been detected at 10 locations inside Fukushima. Plutonium, believed to originate from the Tokyo power plant's crippled Fukushima number 1, has been detected at 10 locations in four municipalities in the Fukushima prefecture, said the science ministry. Highest reading was 11 becquerels of plutonium-238, detected in the town of Nami. The figure is about 1.4 times more plutonium than was originated from the fallout immediately from the explosion. However, the municipality said there were no health hazards. Thank goodness. Other municipalities are Okuma, the village of Iate, and the city of Minasoma. Severe abnormalities are found in Fukushima butterflies, said this is from a story in the BBC News. Exposure to radioactive material released into the environment has caused mutations in butterflies found in Japan. Scientists found an increase in leg, antenna, and wing-shaped mutations among butterflies collected following the 2011 Fukushima accident. The link between mutations in radioactive material has been shown by laboratory experiments, they report. Work has been published in the journal Science Reports. 2 months after Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant accident, a team of Japanese researchers collected 144 adult pale blue, grass blue Zazeria maha butterflies from 10 locations in Japan, including the Fukushima area. When the accident occurred, adult butterflies would have been overwintering as larvae. Unexpected results, they say. By comparing mutations found on the butterflies collected from different sites, the team found that areas with greater amounts of radiation in the environment were home to butterflies with much smaller wings and irregularly developed eyes. It has been believed in the past that insects are very resistant to radiation, said lead researcher Joji Otaki from the University of Ryukyu in Okinawa. In a sense, our results were unexpected, he told BBC News. Pale grass blue butterfly, the Japanese researchers have been studying the species for more than a decade. Professor Otaki's team then bred these butterflies within labs 1,000 miles from the accident where artificial radiation could hardly be detected. It was by breeding these butterflies that they began to notice a suite of abnormalities that they hadn't been seen in previous generation that collected from Fukushima, such as malformed antenna, which the insects used to explore the environment and seek out mates. 6 months later, they again collected adults from the 10 sites and found the butterflies from Fukushima area showed a mutation rate more than double that of those found sooner after the accident. The team concluded that this higher rate of mutation came from eating contaminated food, but also from mutations of the parents' genetic material that was passed on to the next generation, even though these mutations were not evident in the previous generation's adult butterflies. A team of researchers have been studying that particular butterfly for over 10 years. These were considered using species as environmental indicators before the Fukushima accident, as previous work had shown it had been very sensitive to environmental changes. We reported the real-time field evolution of color patterns of the butterfly in response to global warming before, and this butterfly is found in artificial environments such as gardens and public parks. This butterfly can monitor human environments, Professor Otaki said. Sort of the butterfly in the coal mine, so to speak. The study is important and overwhelming in its implications for both human and biological communities living in Fukushima, explained University of South Carolina biologist Tim Musso, who studied the impact of radiation on animals and plants in Chernobyl and Fukushima, but was not involved in this particular research. These observations of mutations and morphological abnormalities can only be explained as having resulted from exposure to radioactive contaminants, Dr. Musso told the BBC News. Another story on Arctic ice melting at an amazing speed. Scientists in the Arctic are warning this summer's record-breaking melt is part of an accelerating trend with profound implications. Norwegian researchers report that the sea ice is becoming significantly thinner and more vulnerable. Last month, the annual thaw of the region's floating ice reached the lowest level since satellite monitoring began more than 30 years ago. It's thought that the scale of the decline may even affect Europe's weather. The melt is set to continue for at least another week. The peak is usually reached in mid-September when temperatures here remain above freezing. Unprecedented, said the Norwegian Polar Institute. They're at the forefront of Arctic research, and its international director, Kim Holman, told the BBC that the speed of the melting was faster than they had expected. It's a greater change than we could have imagined 20 years ago and even 10 years ago. And it's taken us by surprise. We must adjust our understanding of the system. We must adjust our science, and we must adjust our feelings for the nature around us. The Institute has been deploying its icebreaker, Lance, to research conditions between the Svalbard and the Greenland, the main route through which ice flows out of the Arctic Ocean. During a visit to the port, one of the scientists involved, Dr. Edmund Hansen, told me he was amazed at the size and speed of this year's melt. As a scientist, I know this is unprecedented in at least as much as 1,500 years. It's truly amazing. It's a giant dramatic change in the system, Dr. Hansen said. This is not a short-lived phenomenon. This is an ongoing trend. You lose more and more of the ice, and it's accelerating. You can just look at the graphs, the observations, and you can see what's happening. Thinner and thinner ice. Okay, I do want to mention that in addition to the Progressive News Network, I want to urge you to patronize our good friends and colleagues, Gwen Holden Berry and her show Here Be Monsters, which is on Sunday evenings and throughout the week. And also our friend Brian Stetton, whose show Progress Toward Democracy is on Monday evenings and Friday evenings. And also the Susan Nylon Show out of the west coast of Florida, the Susan Nylon Report. And I think that's on Monday through Friday. And you can check these all out online. They're available both live and as podcasts. So make sure you enjoy the information they're providing. They always bring a wonderful array of guests on and important information. Also, I do want to mention my colleague Mickey Royce, my co-producer, without whose efforts these shows could not continue. Okay, next story up. Cesium-laden fish may point to ocean hotspots. This by Mizohi Aoki. Record high 25,800 becquerels per kilogram of radioactive cesium has been detected in fish caught within 20 kilometers of Fukushima. There we go. 258 times the government's legal limit for consumption. Okay, so you probably want to eat one 258th of a serving or maybe nothing. They also said that in Greenling, which are a bottom fish that lives around rocks and reefs in coastal waters, TEPCO said it will check further for contamination of greenlings, sea creatures that bottom feed are including crabs and prawns. The utility will examine soil from nearby seabed to try to ascertain the reason behind these extremely high contamination levels. One possible reason is there's some kind of hot spot on the ocean floor. We also see that there's another story. Now, this is a more positive story. We've got New Zealand granting a river the rights of personhood. Yes, here in America, we give corporations personhood. They want to give gametes, sperm and egg personhood. But here we go. New Zealand has granted a river the rights of personhood. From the dawn of history and cultures throughout the world, humans have been prone to imbue Earth's life-giving rivers with qualities of life itself, a fitting tribute, no doubt, to the wellsprings upon which our past and present civilizations so heavily rely. But while modern thought has come to regard these essential waterways more clinically over the centuries, that might be changing once again. Meet the Whanganui. You might call it a river, but in the eyes of the law, it is the standing of a person. In a landmark case for the rights of nature, officials in New Zealand recently granted the Whanganui, the nation's third longest river, legal personhood in the same way a company is, which will give it rights and interests. The decision follows a long court battle for the river's personhood initiated by the Whanganui River Iwi, an indigenous community with strong cultural ties to the waterway. Under the settlement, the river is regarded as a protected entity under an arrangement in which representatives from both the Iwi and the national government will serve as legal custodians toward the Whanganui's best interests. Today's agreements, which recognize the status of the river as Te Awa Tapua, an integrated living whole, and the inextricable relationship of the Iwi with the river as a major step toward the resolution of historic grievances of the Whanganui Iwi, and is important nationally, says New Zealand's Minister for Treaties for the Whangati negotiations. The Whanganui Iwi also recognized the value others place on the river and wanted to ensure that all stakeholders and the river community as a whole are actively engaged in developing the long-term future of the river and ensuring its well-being, said Finlayson. Although this is likely the first time a single river has been granted such a distinction under law, chances are it's not the last. In 2008, Ecuador passed a similar ruling giving its forests, lakes, and waterways rights on par with the humans in order to ensure the protection from harmful practices. And while it may seem an odd extension of rights, in many ways it harkens back to a time when mankind's fate was more readily acknowledged as being intertwined with that of the rivers, lakes, and streams that sustain us, a time in which our pure instincts toward preserving nature needn't have been dictated by legislation. The Bolivian government has proposed a groundbreaking new law that would grant all of nature equal rights to those of human race. Earlier this year, Bolivia has passed its own La Ley de Retiros de la Madre Tierra, or the Law of Mother Nature, a part of a complete restructuring of the Bolivian legal system following a change of constitution in 2009. The Law of Mother Earth is the world's first piece of legislation to grant the planet absolute protection against those who would seek to exploit or destroy its resources or ecosystems. The new law establishes 11 new rights for nature. You might want to get a pencil and paper out. They include the right to life and to exist, the right to continue vital cycles and processes free from human alteration, the right to pure water and clean air, the right to balance, the right not to be polluted, and the right to not have cellular structure modified or genetically altered. I hope the people from Monsanto were listening to that. The Guardian reports that the law has been heavily influenced by a resurgent indigenous Andean spiritual worldview, which places the environment and the earth deity known as Pachamama, I want to make sure you got that, at the center of all life. Humans are considered equal to all other entities, as if we were part of nature, not apart from it. Imagine that. The Law of Mother Earth redefines Bolivia's tin, silver, gold, and other raw mineral deposits as blessings, and they seek to protect the planet from the mega infrastructure and development projects that affect the balance of ecosystems and the local inhabitant communities. It's not clear at this stage how the somewhat abstract legislation would be implemented, writes Olivia Salone for Wired. The state needs to be careful to balance the rights of nature with the regulation of industry, such as mining, that can contribute a significant chunk of the country's GDP, an important phrase known to corporations throughout the land. Now, Bolivia is seeking to bring these principles worldwide with a UN treaty. The treaty in draft at this time would give Mother Earth the same rights as humans, including the right to live, the right to water and clean air, the right to repair livelihoods affected by human activities, and the right to be free from pollution. Ladies and gentlemen, I'll tell you, we hear about problems every day. We hear about the difficulties. But I am reassured every day when I meet the good people like you who do everything they can to make this a better world. Our union brothers and sisters, the teachers, the educators, the moms and dads, the activists. We heard from many of them tonight. The people that are working to make this a better world. And I want to thank you for the efforts that you make. I'm your host, Rick Spezak, News Director for Progressive News Network. Stay tuned next week when my co-producer will be hosting the show. And also stay tuned toward the end of the month. We're going to do a special on the Middle East. So thanks so much for joining us. Thanks on behalf of all my guests. Thanks on behalf of myself and my co-producer, Mickey Royce. It's a better world to come in. Thanks to the efforts that we make every day. Keep up the good work, my friends. Saludarnosh.